for joining us for this conversation. This is our third kind of partner and spouse session on Zoom. Overall, we wanted to kind of offer this as an opportunity for folks who are the partners and spouses of our healthcare team members to have a place to kind of voice concerns, ask some questions. And overall, we hope that the kind of the tone of this is a little less kind of medical technical and a little more kind of informational, and also have a bit more of a chance to kind of maybe even think through some of the emotional side of what's happening and how it's impacting all of us. Just to add to that, we were able to receive a number of questions in advance from folks, so thank you for submitting questions. I will also be monitoring, along with Lisa and others, the chat function to see kind of what questions you have that are coming up as we're discussing. And again, since we are kind of emphasizing this for partners and spouses, we will definitely be kind of prioritizing those questions first and foremost. We do run a town hall every Friday afternoon, and that town hall tends to carry a little bit more of kind of the technical responses to PPE, that personal protective equipment, concerns that might be coming up for healthcare providers. So feel free to kind of add questions to that town hall if you have more technical questions. And again, we're going to kind of think about reserving this space for partners and spouses to think a little bit more about kind of the challenges of having healthcare workers coming in and out of your homes and how you even are moving through the world right now as well. So on this call, there are kind of three folks that I'll introduce a little more formally, and we're going to kind of pepper them with questions. So first, Jared Baden. He is a professor of global health, epidemiology, and infectious disease. And so he will be kind of our infectious disease pro on this call. And I've given him some questions in advance, but I'll ask all the questions publicly and then let Jared and others respond. We also have Trish Critic, who's a critical care doc and has been supporting our ICUs. She's also the Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs. And she's also a partner of somebody who's supporting the COVID ICUs at Harborview as well. So I'll lean on her a little bit around questions around supporting partners as well in this. And Andrea Klaus, thank you for being here. Assistant professor in dermatology and a partner of a doctor also supporting COVID patients. So those will be our kind of three folks we'll lean on a little bit throughout the hour. So again, thank you for joining us. I'll introduce myself because I forgot, just like Trish tends to do. My name is Anne Browning. I'm the Assistant Dean for Wellbeing, and I've had kind of the great honor and privilege of trying to kind of support both our healthcare teams and families in this kind of COVID-19 crisis. So again, thank you for being with us for this next hour. The first thing I was going to do is actually invite Jared as our kind of infectious disease pro to kind of share about 5 minutes of kind of thoughts and reflections on what he's seen, trends, things that might be kind of helpful to hear as kind of a foundation for this conversation. Jared, go for it.
Hi, Anne. Hi, everybody again. And in spite of Anne's introduction that this would not be technical, then she asked for the first person to give a technical update, I think I'm going to limit it to, Anne asked me to talk about the sort of national local trends and what we're seeing. So I just want to take a couple minutes to do that. So first of all, it's nice to see everybody again. Second of all, it's been a busy couple of weeks since this, since the last week or two, since we had this last meeting. And, this is a really tough week for the U.S. in general, but it's also a very different sort of week for us here in Washington State and in other places on the West Coast. So I want to talk about them differently. As I think was forecast a few weeks ago, the U.S. peak continues, the U.S. cases continue to rise, and in places that are very hard hit, it's a very, very difficult time for medical systems and for public health systems, medical systems, and for people and families living in those places. And I think people watch plenty of news to be able to see that. The local situation is interesting in that the local situation, I think, also is sort of forecast a few weeks ago, seemed to slow. And the most recent modeling data put out by IHME at the University of Washington, some of the most cited data, suggest that Washington State's peak resource utilization may have already been reached as of sometime last week. So that the burden on hospitals, both ICUs and acute care floors, may have been its peak burden may have passed already. That doesn't mean that transmission is over or that we're anywhere out of the danger zone of the woods now with this virus transmitting in communities. But it does mean that all of the things that had been planned, have been forecast, are occurring. That the virus transmits to a lot of people, and then with social distancing, the burden begins. Eventually, you see a burden decreasing. There have been lots at the same time, so we can talk about that more as it goes on. I think we should all be very proud, both of our public health systems and our medical systems here in Seattle and Washington State, about the action taken to be able to, on social distancing, physical distancing in the last few months, to be able to move us apart from each other and stop chains of transmission, and the preparatory work done by our medical systems to be ready for the patient numbers that have been coming in. It's very impressive to see numbers fall from their estimate. Numbers never achieve what their estimates had been set to be, and in Washington State, dropping every time the models get rerun, which is really a testament to all of you who are sitting at home watching this and not out doing all the things that we normally do, because it's that social distancing that's made the effect. And then our hospitals continue to work, both for patients with coronavirus and really for everybody who's got anything else going on with them right now. There have been a lot of policies in the last few weeks. I think two of them that have gotten the most sort of media attention are sort of questions about masks and masks for everyone in public, and we can talk about those at any point if people have questions on that, as well as then some of the even yesterday, sort of the governor's policy on extending school closures, K-12 school closures, as well as social distancing recommendations here in Washington State. And we can talk about what those mean epidemiologically, and also what it might mean. I think one of the questions we'll talk about at some point eventually is what it might take to move towards a more normal existence again. So really excited to hear everybody's questions today. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jared. Andrea and Trish, I wanted to give you a chance to maybe introduce yourselves a little bit more and share kind of anything you're seeing kind of from where you sit. Andrea, do you want to go first?
Sure. So I'm Andrea Calouse, and I am a physician at the University of Washington, but also my partner is a physician that works in another community hospital, taking care of COVID patients, and has just finished. I'm at home today, and they've just finished a week of being on service there. And so I have a perspective too of kind of knowing what's going on in my immediate work environment, and having somebody who's doing work in COVID that's outside of all, I don't get their emails, I don't get all of their meetings and their discussions. And so I know what it's like to worry about somebody who is doing work that might put them at risk, and wanting to make sure that they are safe and wanting to take care of them well at home. So I can share with you some of my thoughts about how we've approached that, and also look forward to hearing what your questions are.
Good. Thank you. Trish.
And I'm Trish Critic, as Anne said. I am a pulmonary critical care doctor. I mostly do just critical care, and I work at UWMC Motley campus. I spent all of last week being the attending who was supposed to staff the second ICU that we would open if we had the influx of patients that was predicted. And it ended up that we didn't open that second ICU because we didn't have that influx of patients that was predicted. I'll tell you that I've talked with many of my friends who I trained with or worked with who are working in New York City, in Denver and Boston, in New Orleans, and in those cities, they've had 5, 6, 7 ICU services, meaning somewhere between 50 and 100 intubated patients in their hospitals that they're caring for. So it's been a very different experience. And I spent all last week kind of thinking about that a lot as I waited to be called into action for our service. And that's actually been true across our sites for the most part, that we haven't activated a second critical care service entirely. It's a little bit different at Harborview, and Valley Medical Center is having more critically ill patients there than they did for sure a week ago. But nothing like what we're seeing on the East Coast and in parts of the middle of the country. And as Andrea said, I also have a significant other who's also a physician. He is in this system, and he is a pulmonary critical care doctor, just like me, who's working at Harborview. And in the last week, he has been the attending in the COVID ICU over at Harborview, and he's also worked a couple nights in the ICU as well. So I also am a significant other of somebody who's taking care of COVID patients at the same time. And I can also reflect on some of the stuff that we're doing to try to deal with that. I'll add, I also have family who are affected by this. So just like everybody else on this call, we all have extended families who are reaching out to us as well. And I think that might be something that people might ask about. So I'll stop there, Anne, and let you kind of get into your questions.
Thank you all for the introductions and kind of the opening statements. I would say one overarching question that just came in the last like 15 minutes or so is essentially, you know, what would you recommend healthcare professionals do to protect their families when they return home from work? That seems kind of foundational to all the questions that will follow. So, you know, how do you go home and what do you recommend as kind of a procedure for how folks return from work? Trish, I might even tap you on this since you're kind of close to that. Andrew, you as well, maybe.
Sure. We talked about this last time, so I will tell you what we do, and I know everyone does it slightly differently. And Andrew reminded me of the first step last time that I forgot when I first came in. So the first thing we do is we wash our hands, and that's the truth. Andy's washing his hands so often that I had to make an order for like high quality hand cream because our hands are getting chafed from so much hand washing. So hand wash, we wear scrubs when we're at the hospital. We actually change out of the scrubs at the hospital and come home in other clothes. But then after hand washing, the next thing that we do is shower and then come back downstairs and go about whatever it is that we're going to do after that. I know Andrea's house is a no shoe house because she said that last time. We're a loosely no shoe house, but we're more of a strict no shoe house now than we used to be. So shoes stay outside, or at the mud area. And then we go about our lives pretty much like normal in our house, and we don't have small children. So I'm going to let the folks who do have children talk a little bit more about that, but we do try to honor the fact that we want to clean, shower, hand wash, and we also want to be normal with each other in the ways that we need to be to stay strong as a couple and as a family. So, I don't know, Andrew, do you want to add to that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of that is really similar in our household too. So I have my husband and then myself, and then I have two kids. They're ages 12 and 10. And so when, you know, one thing I just double check with my husband, I just support him in doing everything that he can at work to stay, you know, to be careful with following the guidelines that are set for them about how to take care of themselves at work. And then when he gets home, again, we are that no shoe house, and then wash hands, clean up, and then we just kind of act as a normal family. Everybody is washing their hands in our family a lot more. And my kids both have really chapped hands. I'm a dermatologist, like this shouldn't happen in my household. But my kids still have really chapped hands. So just really emphasize the hand washing in our house too. And then we pretty much interact as we normally would.
Cool. Thank you both. We've got a couple questions. from folks around this, you know, PPE, which is this personal protective equipment. So things like these masks, shields. We hear a lot of those questions around kind of how they pertain to life within the hospital. But it sounded like a lot of folks had some questions for clarification of kind of how this virus spreads and things that, you know, PPE that they should be wearing in and about kind of the home or in and about their environment. So Jared, this first one will probably be for you. We had a question, you know, hearing a lot about kind of this aerosol or droplet transmission. Can you explain kind of what those terms mean and maybe like what kind of mask you should wear for which situation? And then I've got a ton of more questions kind of around PPE as well, but what, how does this thing transmit? And tell me about aerosol and tell me about droplet.
Yeah, and I think this has been a topic that's been in the news like crazy. And it depends how much you're socially distancing yourself from the news also, which I would medically recommend also doing some amount of social distancing from news. Classically, a droplet is bigger and heavier, like the kind of thing that you can see when somebody sneezes and doesn't cover their mouth. And an aerosol is something that's finer and lighter and floats in the air longer. And so it's there's lots of different feelings about which kind of viruses or bacteria, things like tuberculosis, transmit by various kinds of things, by those larger droplets or smaller mists. This virus, most of the discussion has been that it's droplet transmitted, so it transmits for heavier things that are closer in and would get onto our hands if we cough and then maybe onto a doorknob or if we shake hands with somebody. I think there's been enough, there isn't a clear line between a virus or something else that'll transmit by a heavy droplet and by an aerosol, however. And so there's been plenty of anecdotes of cases of transmission, like with a few people sitting at a lunch table together, or that the case that was up north of us, individuals in choir practice together. And whether those are droplets or they're aerosols, I don't think it matters so much. I think the larger question is, what can you be doing to protect yourself when you're out in the environment and when you're out in the world? And that is all the things that we're doing with physically distancing ourselves from people, so that if someone is talking, that any droplets that we all produce when we're talking to each other fall in front of them and don't get to you. And if you're standing here, they'll get to you. And if you're standing there, they don't. Similarly, when we're, the ways that we're washing our hands or if we go to the grocery store, washing our hands after we pay because we have to extend a credit card or something else to someone, that we're trying not to mix our touches with other people. Now, the question of masks has gotten a lot of attention, and maybe I'll answer the mask for a second. So the masks have gotten a lot of attention in the last weeks, and I've been asked by a lot of people about masks. The most important thing to emphasize is that the key people to have masks are all the people who are working in the hospitals right now. And so one of the tensions that's been going on with masks is making sure that there are enough masks for the phlebotomists and nurses and doctors and whomever are seeing patients in hospitals to be able to have masks. Then beyond that, whether the rest of everyone else who's not, when we're not working in the hospital, or those of us who don't work in the hospitals, whether us wearing masks makes a big difference, has gotten tons of debate. The CDC has recommended, and Washington State followed, that there's a recommendation for people to consider wearing a mask when they're out in public in situations where they're interacting with other people where they couldn't socially distance. So like paying for a coffee or picking up your takeout or paying at the grocery store. The biggest thought there is that the mask is probably protecting people who might have low symptom infection or no symptom infection from spreading their droplets to other people. It doesn't replace, wearing a mask doesn't replace physical distancing, doesn't replace washing our hands, and a mask is not a shield. It doesn't make people invincible to getting infection or transmitting it. So it's only one part of what is the much larger piece of things that we have to be doing to making sure that we're not having contacts with other people.
Yeah, thank you. We talked a little bit at the last town hall. I think the CDC had just released kind of their recommendation around wearing cloth masks when out in public in spaces where you're going to have to come within 6 feet of somebody, as you mentioned. We had kind of questions around, you know, do cloth masks work? One, and these things, if I'm wearing this, but then it's reusable, any recommendations on kind of cleaning your own personal PPE?
Yeah, so the science that cloth masks work is really limited, but the thought is it can't, if someone, it definitely reduces, particularly if someone is asymptomatic but infected or has really low symptoms infected, it will reduce the number of those droplets that they send out into the world. So that is a great, that's the idea that's driving a lot of the use of cloth masks. I'd wash a cloth mask.
Will it?
Wash them. Yeah. Just normal laundry.
Yeah, drop it in the laundry. This virus is fragile. So in spite of everything that it's doing to the world, where it's obviously devastating, the virus itself is fragile and breaks down in soap, which is why soap, as much as it's doing damage to all of our hands, soap and water break down this virus easily. Sunlight and friction and other things break down this virus easily. So throwing a mask into soap and water is going to kill this virus.
Nice. Okay.
I mean, and you know, I'm sure Andrew has this too. While Andy's scrubs stay at the hospital, his socks come home and various other parts of his clothing come home. And we just throw it into the wash and wash it with the rest of the stuff. And I would think of the mask in the same sense and have a lot less on it than the socks that are wandering around in patients who have COVID disease. I would just add one thing to what Jared said, which I 100% agree with, which is we don't want masks to make people who might have mild symptoms go out. Mm. So if you have mild symptoms, you should still stay home. And if you have anything that you're worried about in terms of symptoms, you should stay home. Because one of the fears, and I think we have an outstanding community that has risen to the occasion so inspiring fashion that I think people are staying home. And we're also getting stir crazy. So I think sometimes it's easy to go out. But if you have symptoms at all, and that's for healthcare workers and anybody else, we don't want people to be falsely assured that they're not going to spread it because they have a mask on. We'd rather you stay home until you really don't have any symptoms and then go out.
Good. I've got, this kind of leads into a next set of questions around, you know, concerns around needing to physically distance or have some kind of protection from your partner or spouse who's coming home. And Andrea and Trish, you both kind of spoke to this. But there's kind of the question of, should I try to be keeping some physical distancing from my partner when he, she, they returns home? Or should my partner and I both be wearing masks when we're in the same room in the house? What are your thoughts there? And I'll open it up to all three of you if you want to chime in.
When my thinking around this is that I've realized is that every family really has to make decisions that they feel most comfortable with. And that may look different from one household to another. And I think when we are checking in with the people we love and making sure they feel loved and supported and helped in this time in the best way we can, then we're probably, and we're within the guidance of what our professionals tell us is good, then I think we're in a good space. But I also acknowledge completely that some people feel like it's best for them if their children are in another place right now, or if they sleep in a separate room from the rest of their family. I've talked to a lot of healthcare providers that are doing different things that our family is doing. And I just want to acknowledge that there's space for variation.
Yeah, I would echo the same thing. I think everyone has to do what feels comfortable for them and their family. And we opt to do what we described already, and that works for us. And it may feel different when there's two healthcare providers who are the two adults in the relationship. That might feel different if that weren't the case, because we both are going into places where we're exposed at different levels, obviously with as the standard PPE that we think is keeping us safe. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's different if it's two healthcare providers in a relationship. And so I think you have to do what feels good for your family and for you. And that could involve PPE. It could also involve maintaining physical touch, because that's really important. And so I think actually one of the biggest challenges of physical distancing is that lack of physical touch. And for us, that's really important to maintain ourselves sane and healthy during a time that's stressful in a lot of other ways. But again, I would completely concur with Andrew that every family has to decide what feels best for them.
Yeah. One of the last questions that came in before we started this session was exactly about kind of, Trish, what you just alluded to, this perception that there's kind of this additional challenge in dual healthcare families or additional risk. And I'll just ask for either of you, is there anything you would add to what you've already shared in terms of ways in which you're trying to minimize the risk of being in families where you have multiple healthcare professionals who are out and in service? It's all right if not.
I don't think I have anything other than what I've just talked about, to be honest. I think I will just say what we do isn't what every single couple that is two healthcare workers do. I have a good friend who sleeps in another room from his significant other, and that's just what feels good to them. He'll tell you it's because they're both not sleeping well and keeping each other awake all night, so they've decided to sleep in other rooms. Okay, fine. Whatever feels good at this point in time. I think makes sense, but I don't think there's a right answer. I guess I'll say it that definitively. I don't think there's a right answer. And I think it's something that probably, like many things in relationships, you should have a conversation about and speak frankly with each other and talk about what your concerns are. But I don't have any other specific ways to mitigate that risk other than the things we've talked about. And then doing the stuff that Andrea alluded to that she says to Bob as he goes off to work, which is follow the precautions that we do in the hospital as rigorously as we can. Like this is, and I say the same thing too. I say, stay safe every time that we go off and do our own thing, because I want us to follow those rules. I don't know, Jared, do you have things to add to that?
I really like what you said. I think I would say that all of the approaches are right. I think we would validate them all. Now we've got, in spite of the fact that this is only weeks old in our lives, we've got lots of data now to show that hospital workers who have good PPE are not getting infected. And that's the experience with the UW medicine system so far, is that we've got lots and lots of health workers who have been doing lots and lots of care in emergency inpatient ICU settings who are staying healthy because of really good processes for getting PPE, having enough PPE, and really good processes for using that PPE. But at the same time, if for some individuals and families, any amount of risk doesn't work within people's minds, and that's okay. And so I think all three of us are validating that any procedure that people take is the right one.
Yeah. But good question. Oops, sorry, Andrea, go ahead.
I was going to add one thing, Andy. The other thing that I think we've seen in the healthcare system that I think I've tried to adopt in my own family too is that every week there's a little bit of change into what we consider policy. And so I kind of try to have a little bit of a family meeting, you know, every few days, every week, and be like, how are people doing with this? How are people feeling about this? Because we could change our family practice if somebody is feeling unsafe, if somebody is feeling distanced too far, and we can adjust that. And we don't have to have, nobody knows, we're going through this pandemic together for the first time, and we're going to have to adapt as we go.
We had a good question come in on the chat, kind of relative to thinking about social distancing and what are factors that come into play. So Jared, this might be one that you can start with. The person is saying that they're in a household that has an 8-week-old, a 2-year-old, and a 69-year-old grandmother kind of all there. Does that change kind of your thinking around how you would think about social distancing or healthcare provider coming in and out of that space. And I think that part of the question also kind of asks, you know, would you consider having somebody live in a different space outside the home during the time they're in service?
I think it in part it determines what that partner who's the healthcare provider is doing. One of the other questions that came through is what if your partner is a social worker within the UW system, and thus and like right now would be having very little direct contact with most clients in the inpatient or outpatient setting, and that's a pretty low risk interaction. Mm-hmm. Like many of us who do a mix of inpatient outpatient setting, most of my interaction with my outpatients has gone to virtually zero now because I'm doing all of my visits for outpatients through telemedicine or through phone. And so that risk is zero. And I think for our social work colleagues, much of that risk has gone down now. And maybe perhaps for those individuals, more of their social contact is actually through regular life, through an occasional grocery store run or paying for gas or whatnot. And so it's a part of it's what the exposure is, and then part of it is what the risk you're willing to tolerate, what level of risk really means for you. And so for a household who's got individuals at the closer to extremes of age, so someone who's in that above 50, 60, 70 cutoff where particularly if they have other risk factors and you're really worried about what coronavirus could mean if they were to become infected, or someone who's extremely young, like the 8-week-old, that may be enough where if your family was structured somewhat differently, that may be enough that you would say, if this child was 8 years instead of 8 weeks, I would feel differently. And that would be, I think we would all validate that. I think what you're trying to keep in mind is with all of these decisions is sort of weighing risks in the same way that, not in the same way, but in a very similar way to we reduce our risk every time that we put on a seatbelt in a car. And we reduce our risk by making decisions about how we drive, and each of those carries risks as well. Those risks are a little bit, because they're so common in our lives, we think about them less. But it's the same decisions that we're all making in terms of trying to minimize as much as we can the risks that we can deal with, and then making the family decisions, like Andrea talked about what the plan and the status is for all of us that day.
Yeah. I'm seeing the question come up in that chat that came up in kind of the pre-submitted questions as well. It kind of takes us a little bit back to PPE, but it's kind of a question around how are folks thinking, and maybe this can be kind of a UW response to, Trish, you might have some insight on this. How are we thinking about universal masking for folks that are in service? So the social worker who might not be in directly relating to patients might actually be around a lot of colleagues, though, in tighter quarters than we would want them to be. So thoughts on universal masking and where we're at policy-wise?
So this is one of those things where Andrew was saying things evolve. And so where we are right now with our policy is that we have what we would call optional universal masking, which means that for every member of the healthcare team, if they decide that they would like to wear a mask during the day, they're issued a mask at the start of the day, and that's the mask that they wear throughout the day. And they keep track of their mask, and at the end of the day, they discard their mask. And anyone in our hospitals or clinics can choose to do this, and they're provided a mask. We aren't in a situation where we're asking every single person who comes in the hospital to be masked all the time. I think the decision was made by our leaders in infectious disease and infection prevention and our clinical leaders across all our entities together to say, we want people to feel as comfortable as possible as they go about their day. And if this is going to make folks feel better as they do their jobs, as they worry about things like asymptomatic transmission, we want to acknowledge that and have them have a mask be available. We also still feel that for the most of us, for the most part, we're able to maintain physical distancing, and thus we don't need to do that all the time. So right now it is available, but not required for everybody who comes into the hospital. In addition, I think we support what the CDC said, which is when out of the hospital or clinic, if you're in a place where you feel like you can't maintain physical distancing, that wearing a mask makes sense. So support people doing that if in those situations, which for me personally seems very rare that I'm actually in a space where I can't maintain physical distancing outside of the hospital, even in the grocery store. For I mean, everyone makes their own decisions, but I think people are listening and not being too close a lot of the time. And then obviously masking is different in the care of COVID patients. And that I think is a little bit more complicated, but I think the questions are usually around people in the hospital now wearing masks, and that's where our policy stands. And Jared, if you want to make any nuances to that, you're welcome to add to what I just said.
I'll say one thing to kind of wrap up a bit that conversation around folks coming from hospital settings into the house and back and forth. I wanted to kind of acknowledge the amount of stress that kind of lands on you as partners and spouses and family members, and kind of both navigating taking care of the person who's doing the healthcare work and kind of trying to take care of yourself and trying to kind of keep your kiddos safe at the same time. And that is a really challenging balancing act. And I just want to kind of acknowledge that is a very challenging space to be in. And we so appreciate your efforts in, taking care of the folks who have to come in to our hospitals, and also appreciate the work you're doing to take care of yourselves. And this is a challenge on that front. One thing, I had a chance to be in a conversation with Dr. Jürgen Unter yesterday, and he's our chair of our Department of Psychiatry. And he was talking a little bit about what he's seen as a trend over the last couple weeks where, really there was just a huge amount of anticipatory fear a couple weeks back where we just didn't know what was coming. We didn't know how it would affect us. We didn't know if we'd be able to kind of stay healthy ourselves. And certainly we have members of our community who are sick. But what he was actually saying yesterday is that we're starting to see that some exposure is actually, to kind of living through this has actually been good in terms of kind of our mental health and well-being. And Jared mentioned this as well, that, we're now at a place where we have seen our healthcare team members using good PPE, giving care, and staying healthy. And that, I think, is starting to lower some levels of anxiety kind of in our community here. So I wanted to both kind of acknowledge that incredible stress and tension still and kind of finding some balance, but also acknowledge that we're learning how to kind of be in this and kind of live through it together. The next set of questions are kind of around the what ifs, and there's some really challenging what ifs. What should I do if my partner knows that he, she, or they have had an exposure and thinking about, being exposed to COVID-19? They're not sick yet. They're not symptomatic, but we are just kind of waiting. Is there anything we should do there? And I'll add a layer, Jared, since I think you might take this one. If my partner does get sick and does test positive, what do you recommend we do in that scenario as well?
Yeah, so, Trish, also jump in, please. If someone gets sick with symptoms suggestive of coronavirus, I think there are a few things to think about doing. First of all, is to figure out how to get a test and work through the systems within the UW has very good systems to be able to, for employees and also people who go to UW Medicine and now more people, to be able to get a test that can be figured out. Obviously, as Trish said before, like with any symptoms, people should be staying at home. People should be staying home anyway. And then with any symptoms, people should be staying at home. And then what the recommendation has been is that for individuals who do have infection or presumed infection, that they should be isolating themselves from others who don't have infection. And so people have done this sort of locking up in one bedroom for a period of time until they are through their symptoms and beyond. And the recommendations have generally been sort of 7 days and plus 72 hours since the last symptoms. And for, you know, for many people that there are some really lovely stories online and et cetera about families living in the same house but not living in the same house for a period and communicating with each other through what would be a really difficult time if someone was sick.
Yeah. For sure. Andrea, do you have any kind of additional comments to that? Like what to think about if somebody is sick?
I mean, I think Jared described what is going to be a challenge for a lot of people because people have different amount of space to be able to self-isolate. And I think we do want people to try to isolate in that situation so that we're minimizing other people being infected. I do think testing is really important, and we have really rapid turnaround time for testing right now. So in the hospital, it's less than 8 hours. And for healthcare workers who are being tested as an outpatient, it's usually within a day. Not always, but usually within a day. And we want folks to get tested. Going back to your first scenario, Anne, where somebody was asymptomatic and had an exposure,
yeah.
I think what we do in that situation, again, is kind of do what the family feels comfortable with in terms of whether or not you isolate or not. I think that's a harder one. And we track symptoms. And then if there's symptoms, then we want you to get tested as quickly as possible. But there's, I mean, I will say that Andy had two times that he was exposed where we just kind of went about the way we were normally living and tracked symptoms. And that was, the one was because there was a patient who was tested negative and then tested positive later. So it wasn't in protective spaces. And so that's something that happens. And we didn't do anything differently, but we talked about it and talked about what that meant to us and what we wanted to do in that situation. So I think, again, the non-symptomatic part, in some ways, I think you worry a lot and it's not clear that you need to do anything different, but I suspect the worry goes up and we keep watching for symptoms in that situation with a low threshold to test. I don't know, Andrea, if you wanted to add anything.
I mean, I was just going to say, these are really stressful, you know, when the COVID situation really started to expand in Seattle, then my partner had just finished a week of work and found out that several patients that they had taken care of had were positive, you know, and this was before we knew and before PPE was being used. And you know, and you worry that you're going to get sick. And I think it wasn't very long after that I actually came down with symptoms of a cold. I think even I was at home being sick on the first partner call that we hosted. And, you know, I was able to get tested and be able to find out that it was negative, but you're just worried. And I can't emphasize enough that you feel worried and I can't take that away. You know, you have to make decisions like, should I still be caring for my children, you know, while you're waiting for your test results to come back? Like, should I invite in my elderly parents to take care of my children? Yeah. You know, how do we, and I just thought like probably the people in my immediate household have all been exposed to the amount that we have. And we just kind of kept going forward and trying to get the information we needed to make the best next decisions, but it was stressful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you all. I just saw a question in the chat pop up that actually kind of parallels kind of the last section that I had saved of questions, since I think they are a little bit more hopeful. The question was really kind of about recovery, and it was around like, what are these factual developments that will allow schools, restaurants, businesses to reopen? And Jared, if you have a, you know, magic ball, what's your guess as to when that will happen? So what needs to happen before we can open stuff? And then when might it happen? And it looks like there's some additional question in the chat around kind of school opening and herd immunity, but I'll take a peek at that while you're speaking.
Yeah, I left my magic ball at my office.
Nice.
Since I'm at home. So I can't sign. No, what needs to happen to get through this is we need to get through a peak and fingers crossed, it seems like Seattle and Washington State have gotten over their peak resource use, which would really suggest that peak transmission is also in the past, because the resource use lags by a few days of transmission in communities because people have to develop symptoms. So that's good, really good. And we should take a moment to be relieved about that, because it puts us in a good place. It doesn't, you know, it's none of us are forgetting that it's taken weeks of us to get to this peak where we have been in anticipation, and the other side of the peak is sort of has the same shape. It's a shape that goes like this. So it's weeks to go from peak down to low levels of transmission. So we're not anywhere out of the woods yet, but we can be hopeful that we should be hopeful that we are on the right track. You know, the major things that need to happen to move towards more normalcy is getting through peak, getting down to a manageable number of cases, getting down to a place where public health professionals can be able to react rather than being just reactive to emergency, to be able to move back to being reactive to individual cases and to be able to monitor and contain individual cases, because there will continue to be cases of this virus occurring for a long while, it seems. And so since right now we are just spending all public health resources trying to monitor the mass information, to be able to then do what public health does well, and when there are cases that arise, to be able to contain those so they don't spread. And then on the public health side, on the medical side, for the medical system to be able to prepare in case more cases come in. And so that is... Now, of course, our systems have done really good with preparing for surge, and so have doctors at the ready. When those hospitals move back into regular systems, they have to have enough PPE in stock and docs and nurses on backup command to be able to, if more cases start to trickle in, to be able to deal with those. So those are the biggest ones, to get through peak, to have public health systems ready, and to have medical systems ready. And then what will likely happen will be a slow moving back into social connections. That is, in other places in the world, that has involved things like reopening restaurants, but only letting people sit at every other table effectively, something along those lines, where that we really try as a society to maintain social distancing, to be able to see if that reintroduction of some social connections and person-to-person connections results in new transmission at a level that's not okay, or continues to have the transmission levels continue to fall. The question about schools, I think, so I at 2:30 yesterday afternoon, I think there was a collective groan all across Washington State. And I have a 10-year-old, so I groaned as loud as you. At the moment when the governor announced that K-12 schools would be closed for in-person learning for the rest of this academic year, it's a tough decision, one that's definitely above my political grade and pay grade. But the drivers there is, part of it is the epidemiology that there clearly is transmission among children. Probably significant transmission among children, because that's how most respiratory viruses happen, but not significant disease among children. So it's hard to monitor how much is happening there. Mm-hmm. And I think the epidemiology is that the switch to pulling, it's a big switch to reopen schools. Reopening a few restaurants and seeing and people sitting at every other seat is a smaller, much smaller switch than thousands of people coming back into grouping all at once, including our teachers who would be mandatory to have to come in and work. And so I think that's part of that driver. It's a really hard one for everyone.
Yeah. A second part of that question was just around antibody testing. Do we know, is antibody testing coming online? Is that something, you know, that we'll see as kind of the far side of the peak that we start to kind of think about?
Yeah, so the first FDA approved antibody test happened this week, late last week, somewhere along the time. So, and there are a bunch more that are in the development phase. Yes, there will be antibody tests. What is not known right now is what fraction of people who get sick develop antibodies, how long those last for developing antibodies doesn't necessarily mean you have those forever. So for some diseases like measles, once you get the antibodies, you're protected essentially forever. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, for many respiratory viral infections, including other coronaviruses, the antibodies fade over some period. And no one knows for this particular coronavirus, is that going to be a year of protection afterwards, or 2 years, or 3 months? And so that information isn't available yet. The other piece is, given we are probably nowhere near herd immunity, given the number of, even though there have been thousands of detected cases and probably many times that of undetected cases in this country, we are probably nowhere near the levels of immunity that provide us all sort of herd protection yet, unfortunately. So antibody tests will come online at some point, but it's not our only shield.
Yeah, thank you. One question just came in around how people should interact in hospitals. Kind of a question around trying to establish maybe some new norms around working in close quarters. I would say, Trish, if that's you've been in service probably most out of everybody here, are you seeing a change in practice, and is there a real push to try and get kind of physical distancing?
So what I would say is yes and no. I think there is an evolution to working to maintain physical distancing. I was up in the Montlake units over the weekend, and for example, the team room that the medical ICU team works in was too small for them to maintain physical distancing, so they moved to a different space. Unfortunately, it's the patient and family waiting room, but that doesn't have, family waiting room doesn't have families in it right now. But in that space, they could spread out and be always 6 feet apart, which is a change. And so I think we're trying to do things like that. And I see people in various clinical spaces really striving to maintain those 6 feet. I also want to acknowledge that that is completely contrary to the way that we've practiced for years and years and years, and that people are used to coming and being really right next to each other and talking and things like that. So I think it is not fully realized. It's moving in that direction. And I guess what I tried to do when I was rounding in Montlake over the weekend and in Northwest yesterday and last week in Harborview is to remind people, even when we're standing and talking, because I would check in on people to stay 6 feet apart, which is very different practice than what we're used to in our clinical settings. Now, there's some things that we do to deliver clinical care where we need to be closer than 6 feet. And then we need to be cognizant of that and take protections that we need to take. But what I would say is, yes, it's evolving. No, we're not there. And yes, I think all of us need to be empowered to remind each other, including me. You just fall into old habits. When I was rounding yesterday, three different people tried to shake my hand. And then they said, oh, wait, I'm not supposed to shake your hand. And that's just many, many, many years of ingrained behavior of being kind to other people. And the same thing goes with standing close when you're talking. I think we just all have to keep reminding ourselves and each other that we want a little bit more space around us.
Yeah, thank you. Jared, I have one more kind of, question around recovery. With plane travel, do you have any sense of when we're actually going to be able to get, outside of Seattle, without just driving away in our vehicles?
Yeah, this one I felt a lot. So I do, as mentioned at the beginning, I do global health. I fly about 250,000 plus miles a year. And so this has been quite a rock to my world to not fly for this period. I've decided I'm not missing it, actually. But I do want to go on vacation again. It's really up in the air right now. I think
no pun intended.
Yeah, the airlines are airlines continue to operate, and I think people have sometimes really important reasons to be able to travel, and we don't want to dismiss those at all, and I don't want to undermine people's ability to get to family members or to other things that are essential in their lives. I think with time, as we see what the epidemiology of this disease does, and we see countries and cities and localities be able to figure out when they have outbreaks and be able to try to control them, we will see if as a world, as a country and as a world, we can be able to not to limit travel to places where there's outbreak ongoing, and be able to see if that can modulate the system. I think it's especially, the question online was especially for elderly people. I think it's one of the things, and I defer really, this is more in your expertise than others. It is going to be really important as we go forward to figure out what this whole new world means for people who have greater risk of having complications, because we can't have this become, we can't have the fact that this disease has come into our world and will go up and down over time, making people who are already potentially more isolated even more so.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. We're just about at time. So I wanted to, you know, see from the panelists if any of you three had anything else you wanted to kind of say in closing. I'll give you a quick chance to nod or defer. Trish, Andrea, Jared, last thoughts? All right. I did see a question come in that was a bit more technical around some occupational therapy support for COVID patients. Please ask that in our kind of town hall Q&A section so that we can kind of add that to that queue as well. And overall, I would just say thank you so much for sharing an hour with us. It's really insightful and helpful for us to get a sense of how people are doing and what some of the challenges are that you're facing, and therefore kind of what our team members are facing as well. And so thank you very much for being part of the UW Medicine community, and please, please continue to take good care of yourselves and each other. All right. Thank you all. Goodbye.
Bye.